From KALW in San Francisco, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. This is the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. On today's show, we are discussing coverage of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's first trip to Asia. The former Exxon CEO refused to allow reporters to join last week's trip. Instead, he took a reporter from the conservative Independent Journal Review, a website founded by former Republican political operatives, according to Reuters. During his trip, he said the United States would consider military action against North Korea if it was provoked. He also said efforts to halt North Korea's nuclear development have failed over the past 20 years. He said it's time for a new North Korea policy, but offered no new details. Joining us to discuss coverage is Tim Shorrock, a veteran national security reporter and author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you. Good. We're also joined by Paul Blumenthal, a reporter with the Huffington Post, covering campaign finance and money in politics. Paul previously worked as senior writer with the Sunlight Foundation. And later in the show, we're going to talk about media coverage of lobbyists. Paul has a couple of news stories out. One, a lot of lobbyists are holding their annual events in Trump properties. Hi, Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. As we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Paul Blumenthal with the Huffington Post, let's start off with you. What caught your attention this week?
I guess the story that really interested me this week, I think this came out earlier this morning or maybe yesterday in Bloomberg, is a story about auto manufacturer supply companies and their employees. And basically, a lot of these companies that exist in the South here in the United States, they're basically not following labor and safety laws. And they're, these people who are looking for any kind of job, they take a job for $8.50 an hour, which is, good paying, maybe in Alabama, and wind up getting killed by the machinery, or their arms get chopped off. I think that the author of the article says that the stories that he read and the files that he FOIA'd that he received from the government from OSHA, the Office of Safety Oversight, that these files really read like Dickens or like an Upton Sinclair book. That this is still ongoing, this, the manufacturing renaissance that President Trump might want to have happen in this country. In the South, it's really coming along with these kinds of safety violations, people really, losing their arms, losing their legs, in some cases losing their lives when the companies don't provide the proper oversight and training that they're required to do. It's a really terrifying story about the current state of workers in a part of our country.
And this is the so-called boom that Donald Trump is talking about without talking about the importance of unions, so these workers actually have protections on the job.
It's a difference, especially between the North and the South, particularly manufacturing jobs, especially in the auto industry. And this is the auto supply parts industry, which in the South, you get paid less than even working at a Honda factory, and there's so much pressure to get these parts out, to get to the big car manufacturers, whether it's Honda or Toyota. A lot of them are foreign companies coming into the U.S., and there's so much pressure to get these parts out that they don't provide the proper training to the employees and work them, 80 hours a week, 7 days a week. And people, they need the money to live, and it often winds up with these terrible side effects.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up, because senior producer Malihe Razazan pointed this out this morning and just emailed Peter Waldman to be on our show next week. And it's a Bloomberg piece, and again, it's called Inside Alabama's Auto Jobs Boom, Cheap Wages, Little Training, Crushed Limbs. The South's manufacturing renaissance comes with a heavy price. So thank you, Paul, for pointing that one out. That is Paul Blumenthal, a reporter with the Huffington Post, and hopefully we'll get Peter Waldman to join us next week to talk about this important story. And what about you, Tim Shorrock? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I'd have to say Jane Mayer's piece in the New Yorker that came out on, I think it's in this week's issue, but came out online over the weekend, last weekend. She wrote this incredible story about the Mercer family, these secretive billionaires who have funded the Breitbart empire, and also, you know, funded Bannon's rise, Steve Bannon's, Trump's close advisor, and also funded Trump during his campaign. And just their deep influence on the Trump administration and this sort of media empire he's brought in to go over the heads of the media. And her article is just, I mean, Jane Mayer is just such an incredible reporter. But this is a very impressive piece of journalism, very long, very deep dive into this family and their influence. And she just showed, got some incredible quotes, from people that are close to this guy Mercer, who very infrequently, he doesn't speak very much publicly, rarely gives interviews, but she was able to get a lot of information, get a lot of people talking about what things he said, like astonishing things he said, such as, you know, he has this belief that nuclear radiation from the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were actually good for the Japanese people. You know, kind of an insane and totally inhumane way of thinking, but, you know, that's how these people think. And so that was really something. And then, of course, she's the author of this money, this book called Dark Money, about the Koch, you know, the Koch brothers and their influence on the right. And the sort of, you know, resurgence of the right over the last 10 years.
Tim, the one thing that stood out for me listening to Jane Mayer, and she's actually going to be on our show on April 3rd, is that the Mercers invested $10 million in Breitbart. And over the last year, I've been thinking, you know, I've heard of Breitbart, but all of a sudden it has a major platform because Steve Bannon now is in the White House. But I thought, how do they get their funding? Where did they come from? And it's so interesting because Breitbart now has a major platform. I mean, they're being invited to sit on panels with the Columbia Journalism Review. They're being invited to be interviewed on NPR. But there's no mention of this funding, which I think is really important to let listeners know who's backing these institutions.
Absolutely. There should be. And that's why this report is so important, I think.
Paul, what are your thoughts on that? Just being upfront with listeners about following the money. Who's funding Breitbart, for example? Who's funding these different outlets? Who are these people, Robert Mercer? And why are we only now learning about him?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Tim that article by Jane is a really great piece about Bob Mercer. You know, he sort of came into politics. You know, a lot of these billionaires that we hear about, Sheldon Adelson, Paul Singer, the Koch brothers, they've kind of been around for a while, but Bob Mercer just kind of popped up out of nowhere around 2010, 2011 after the Citizens United decision. And I think that Jane and, you know, we had a piece that came out this past week on our long form site, Highline, for Huffington Post about the Mercers as well. And, you know, we're finally kind of diving into he's referred to as a reclusive billionaire. That his thoughts are really, really crazy and out there. You know, he believes that the Clintons have murdered people, that he, you know, I think Tim mentioned the nuclear radiation is good for people who get bombs dropped on them because it will help protect them from future disease or something, some really bizarre idea. You know, he's funded anti-climate change or studies that deny climate change, and other kind of weird scientific efforts. And it's, I mean, it's really, you know, it's an interesting place and terrifying place where we are in our politics where, you know, some random reclusive billionaire can all of a sudden inject himself and have more power than a lot of actual people in society combined together, that they can transform things, including by, you know, surreptitiously funding an incredibly powerful media organization like Breitbart.
Right, because Jane Mayer reports that when Donald Trump's campaign was really faltering, Rebecca Mercer, Robert Mercer's daughter, cornered him at some event and said, look, we've got the people and we've got the money. Let us put you back on track.
Yeah, they essentially came in and basically took over the campaign and, you know, injected Kellyanne Conway, who had long been on their payroll, gave them a, you know, a new data and tech company, Cambridge Analytica, to use, and then, you know, pushed Steve Bannon into that position. And, you know, Bannon had already been pushing Trump at Breitbart for pretty much the whole election. If you go back and listen to his radio shows, you know, he's very, you know, what Trump was saying in the early months before Bannon joined the campaign is pretty much identical to what Breitbart and Bannon had been pushing for years in Breitbart, which is this sort of nationalistic, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, Islamophobic agenda.
And just one more question for both of you, since we're talking about Breitbart. How do you think the media should deal with or handle Breitbart? Breitbart has been invited to be on panels at the Knight Foundation and the Columbia Journalism Review, sitting alongside reporters from The New York Times, The Guardian, and CNN. Tim, what do you think about that?
Well, I think there just needs to be full exposure and you know, full explanation. If someone's like that is going to appear, they need to say who he is and make that very clear. I think, you know, his white supremacy views are pretty, you know, are out there, and people shouldn't kid themselves that this guy has sort of humane views on people, humane, you know, everyday views on people. I mean, he has an extremist take, and I think one of the most dangerous aspects of Bannon in particular is his, you know, he calls himself a Leninist whose purpose is to, you know, destroy the administrative state, take apart all these public institutions we've had for decades that are designed to protect the American people, which goes back to Paul's story about, you know, the auto supply industry in the South. You know, they've already had a problem with appointing this one labor secretary who was clearly corrupt. They want to dismantle all these kinds of protections for workers and for citizens in general. And so, you know, here he is trying to be, you know, Trump-sounding, getting the votes of working class people in America and promising to make America great by bringing back factories and so on. Yet they want to completely disengage from the institutions that actually protect workers' rights, protect their health and safety, and actually have some oversight over unbridled capitalists. And so I think that's one of the most dangerous things. And you know, if he's going to speak at these, you know, vaunted events and, you know, be sort of received as a normal person, I think there needs to be full exposure before they come and while they're there.
Paul, what would you add?
I mean, Breitbart is sort of a political operation, and at the same time, they do some of their reporters do actual reporting on the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're going to come into this sort of institutional roles and institutional places of journalism, then they're going to have to abide by those rules. And, you know, this discussion about the Mercers kind of came out a few weeks ago because they were applying for congressional press passes. And to do so, you have to show that, you know, you are an actual media organization, and you need to reveal the actual ownership structure of your media company. And that's sort of when it came out that Robert Mercer was one of the three owners of Breitbart, was during this process, because they had to have a public hearing at the Capitol before the Press Association. It was revealed that Andrew Breitbart's widow, I believe the editor-in-chief of the company, and Robert Mercer are the three owners of the organization. So, I mean, so long as they're being transparent, they can, you know, anybody should, you know, we should have an open and free press, even if I don't agree with, you know, their take on particular issues.
Well, we will put both of these stories on our website, yourcallradio.org. The one by Jane Mayer that's in this edition of The New Yorker is available online. It's very, very long. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Paul Blumenthal is a reporter with The Huffington Post, and Tim Shorrock is a veteran national security reporter and author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Let's now talk about Rex Tillerson's first major foreign trip to Asia. He took this trip last week, and he broke decades of precedence by refusing to travel with State Department correspondents. Usually, secretaries of state take 10 or more journalists on their overseas trips with them, even when they go to war zones. And Rex Tillerson, the State Department, did not do that. Instead, they decided to invite Aaron McPike on the plane. Aaron is a reporter with the Independent Journal Review. This is a website founded by former Republican political operatives, according to Reuters. There have also been some pieces, Tim, about how Rex Tillerson has yet to answer any questions from the media. There was a video of Andrea Mitchell of NBC kind of being pushed out of a room while she was trying to ask Rex Tillerson questions, and he just kind of sat there and looked straight ahead and really didn't even acknowledge her. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, in a way, that it's part of this, you know, administrative state deconstruction. That's what's happening at the State Department. I mean, one of the first things we have to see about the State Department is that, you know, Tillerson came in and they fired all these deputy secretaries of state and assistant secretaries of state. You know, people who've been there a long time and can kind of, you know, help with the transition. And they just fired them all. So there's this huge gap of people there, for one thing. And he just seems to want to be able to operate, you know, kind of in secret. Although, you know, as I've been, you know, looking into this, some reporters who've been around for a while have said, you know, well, you know, the Secretary of State being sidelined is not that surprising. I mean, during the Nixon administration, for example, William Roger, who was the Secretary of State, was like entirely cut out of, you know, a lot of the diplomacy that Nixon and Kissinger did, for example, with China. He had no idea what was going on, and they just didn't bring him in. Now, that's what they seem to be doing with Tillerson. And but, you know, not bringing the press is just, I mean, it's just more of this kind of, you know, how to control the message, and, you know, Trump's whole thing about fake news. I guess they just want to have people with them who will write, who will basically help write press releases. And the only interview he did during his trip to Asia was with this individual from the Independent Journal Review, and they put that out. But there was nobody there to raise questions, deep questions about what he was doing and the policies that he was talking about or anything.
Paul, what do you make of this? Think Progress reports that once Tillerson traveled to the demilitarized zone that marks the border between South and North Korea, he gave an exclusive interview to Fox News. What do you make of all of this?
I mean, I think it's all of a part with a lot of the Trump administration. I mean, you know, they're trying to sideline the media, as Tim said. You know, Trump talks about fake, you know, we're all fake news. Who shouldn't be believed, you know, every journalist pretty much aside from Fox News and Breitbart and Alex Jones, were the enemies of the American people. You know, we've heard this before, and, you know, someone like Tillerson comes from the private sector where he was the CEO of a large corporation that had a public relations arm. And so, you know, his dealings with the media were completely controlled and on his own terms. You know, he is now a public servant, a public representative of the American people. And that means you can't just ditch the press because you feel like you don't want them around. And honestly, it was bad for him to do this because he, you know, the U.S. press then had to rely on the South Korean press, mm-hmm. who reported things like he was tired and had to leave, which then he disputed. And, you know, if you don't bring along any U.S. press, there's no one else to verify if his side of the story is true or not. It seems like a self-defeating proposition, in addition to also being bad for American democracy.
And what about what happened on the trip? Before we get into Rex Tillerson's comments, for people who don't follow U.S.-Korea policy very closely, Tim, can you just give us a quick overview of what it is currently?
Well, the U.S. and North Korea have been at loggerheads for quite some time, you know, for years, in fact. You know, ever since the first agreement on nuclear weapons was agreed to and during the Clinton administration in 1994. To go back to that time, the United States did negotiate directly with North Korea in 1994, came out with an agreement in which their nuclear and plutonium facilities were shut down for 8 years. And there was international inspectors in there. And the program was stopped, and they were very close to having a deal on missiles at the same time, at the very end of the Clinton administration. And, of course, this was all supported by the government at the time in South Korea, the first Kim Dae-jung, who was a opposition leader for many years and then was elected president, and then his successor in the early years of the Bush administration. But when President Bush came to office, he decided pretty much unilaterally that, you know, North Korea was part of the axis of evil and put them into this camp along with Iran and Iraq, and decided, you know, they were not trustworthy to talk to and have any negotiations. So there really hasn't been any serious negotiations with them, you know, all through this period. And so Obama, President Obama, and Secretary of State Clinton and her successor Kerry sort of had this, you know, what they call, you know, strategic patience. It was basically trying to wait out the North Korean regime, thinking that they would collapse or something, which is ridiculous. That's not going to happen. And, you know, the North Koreans have been, they're not, like, there's this terrible response by people in Congress and even the media to say North Koreans are crazy and they're irrational. They are not. They have a policy. It's logical what they do. They, you know, you may not like their government. They may do terrible things in ways of, you know, it's an authoritarian state, but they have said and made very clear that they are concerned about their national sovereignty and the protection, and they want their government to survive. They want their nation to survive, and they see the U.S. as a threat to that, and they would like to see a peace treaty to end the Korean War. And to so there can be better relations between North and South Korea, and so that's one thing. So you know, Tillerson said while he was in Japan first and then Korea that the period of negotiations is over, strategic patience is done with, and he mentioned a number of possibilities. And there has been a very serious review apparently going on of Korea policy. In which they are discussing, one, preemptive strikes. There's been a lot of attention on that. And two, there's been other possibilities, too. Like they have also mentioned as one possibility of a policy is directly talking to them. And, you know, I think that's what the Chinese are very much pressing for. So Tillerson came in there, and he really acted like an oil man. I mean, he treated South Korea very poorly. You know, it's like, you know, he acted like old empire, you know, American empire. You know, he was very friendly to China, and, you know, his best, you know, he called Japan our close ally. He had less, you know, different words for South Korea. And it's almost like South Korea doesn't exist for the United States. What happens in South Korea and how South Koreans feel about North Korea? That doesn't seem to matter. And the idea of pressing a military solution and actually talking about preemptive strikes, I think, is extremely dangerous. And if we want a war where, you know, a million people could be killed, that's what will happen in that situation. So I really don't see any choice but direct talks at some point with North Korea to you know, move away from this confrontation.
These comments, Tim, that Rex Tillerson made on his trip to Asia, I don't know if you'd call it tough rhetoric or dangerous rhetoric, but he said, let me be very clear, this policy of strategic patience has ended. He said the policies of the past 20 years have failed, and that's a serious statement.
Well, I think he's also wrong, as I mentioned before. I mean, there was 8 years of a negotiated, you know, pact where the North Koreans did freeze their nuclear facilities. And, you know, yes, North Korea did break some of those agreements, but so did the United States. The United States had obligations to provide fuel oil and other things and to come through with their part of the agreement, and that didn't happen. And so, you know, since the beginning of the Bush administration, you know, the tensions have escalated. And, you know, under President Obama, there was no negotiations at all. And I think that's very dangerous. And, you know, like I said, it's sort of like ignores what could happen in a war. I mean, you know, it's not only Tillerson. I mean, as we speak, the United States and South Korea, with Japanese military support, are holding the largest military exercises in the world. They hold these several times a year, and one of the actions they practice in these exercises is what they call decapitation of the leadership. They sent in SEAL Team 6 as part of these exercises. And you know what SEAL Team 6 does, right? They're the ones who killed Osama bin Laden. They're practicing, you know, a test run of, you know, wiping out their North Korean leadership. And they made it very public. That's what SEAL Team 6 was doing there. And so that sends a message that, you know, we're ready to do this. And I think that escalates the situation. I think it is indeed a very dangerous situation. And if the United States wants to rely on China, as they keep doing, then they should listen to them. Because the Chinese foreign minister recently, about a week ago, said, you know, the U.S. and North Korea are like two trains hurling toward each other. Mm. And there could be an explosion. And he suggested the North Koreans, you know, put a moratorium on their missile tests, and the U.S. put a moratorium on these exercises and use that as the basis for the beginnings of talks. But the U.S. immediately rejected that. So, you know, I think we're in a serious situation.
Well, we're going to have to do a show on this because you're right, Tim. So much of the coverage is predictable. It's about a country with a leader who's unstable. We hardly get a nuanced picture of how the country actually functions and what steps should be taken to avoid a military conflict. So we'd love to have you back to talk about that.
I want to mention one more thing.
Sure.
There's a very good piece running in the Nation now online by Dr. Bruce Cummings, who is a historian of the Korean War. And it's just a really excellent piece at the history of the U.S. in Korea. You know, what everyone should know about our relationships with North Korea and why they are scared of the United States. You know, there was a Korean War, people kind of forget that, where the United States completely destroyed North Korea. Mm-hmm. You know, we bombed Japan in a terrible way during World War II, but North Korea was obliterated by those same bombers. And, you know, the United States has threatened them with nuclear weapons many times in the past. And so, you know, there's a lot of history here. And that's rarely mentioned in the U.S. press. And, you know, in fact, you know, a lot of times the people that surround the State Department press are not very good at this history either. And don't really, you know, talk about, you know, those years of the role of the United States that's played in the Korean Peninsula since 1945. And this crisis didn't just begin yesterday. And that's kind of the sense you get from reading the mainstream press. Mm.
Well, we'll definitely do an entire show and we'll bring you back. Thanks so much, Tim, for joining us, and
sure.
Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
That is Tim Shorrock. He's a veteran national security reporter and author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. After the break, we'll continue speaking with Paul Blumenthal, a reporter with the Huffington Post, about media coverage of lobbyists. We'll also be joined by Justin Elliott, an investigative reporter with ProPublica, about his new story, Meet the Hundreds of Officials Trump Has Quietly Installed Across the Government. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller, because we always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're joined by Paul Blumenthal, reporter with the Huffington Post. He covers campaign finance and money in politics. And now I would like to welcome Justin Elliott to the show. Justin is an investigative reporter with ProPublica, where he covers politics and government accountability. Hi, Justin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Great to have you. Before we dive in and talk about your piece about all of the officials that Donald Trump has quietly installed across the government, I just want to ask you about a piece of breaking news that we're getting from CNN. House Speaker Paul Ryan just went to the White House to tell Donald Trump that he does not have the votes to pass the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and he's asking Donald Trump what to do next. A GOP source told CNN's Dana Bash on this. We just did a show about it yesterday, and I just wanted to give people an update. Justin, what are your thoughts about the reporting on this ever-changing bill and whether the Republicans have enough votes?
I mean, I think as a political story, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, there's so much uncertainty about what the Trump administration and the Republican Congress are going to do. I mean, they seem to have sort of painted themselves into a corner. I mean, in terms of the media coverage, I have not been reporting on healthcare myself, but you know, I think there's actually been not enough focus on what the bill is going to do to the healthcare system, and too much on, you know, the sort of horse race aspect of whether Trump is going to have a quote unquote political win or not. But so if I were reporting on healthcare, that's where I'd be focusing on right now. But you know, I think it's remarkable what's happening.
Yeah. Paul, what are your thoughts? What would you add?
I mean, I think it's not terribly unsurprising that this bill is going down. It's been a bizarre process that they've taken to come to, I guess they could come to the floor with it. I guess Paul Ryan doesn't have the votes. But, you know, they've spent three weeks trying to craft some bill that, you know, they've been talking about repeal and replacing Obamacare for 8 years, and now they basically didn't hold any hearings. They haven't consulted with many, you know, Republican health experts. Everybody seems to hate the bill, and it seems to be, I think, one of the reasons why there was coverage, and we've definitely had coverage here about the contents of the legislation and what it would do for people's health insurance and health care. But I think the problem in covering that is that the bill has changed at least three or four times this week. Every 24 hours, there's a new manager's amendment that hasn't been, you know, that isn't released to even be read by people. I mean, this is an absurd process that flies in the face of pretty much any kind of normal legislating that you'd see in Congress. You know, when the Democrats passed the Affordable Care Act, they began holding hearings before Obama was even elected in 2008 in the Senate. Senator Max Baucus did, and you know that they held months, you know, more than 2 years probably of hearings. So this is, it's basically showing that the Republican Party has very little interest in legislating around this issue that they've been campaigning on for ever since the bill was passed. You know, they've been running campaign ads saying we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. You know, Obamacare is a disaster for people, but they have, you know, no alternative at all.
We did cover the details, but as you both said, they're changing very quickly. You can find yesterday's show at yourcallradio.org. According to other reports, Donald Trump says if they cannot get the votes by today, then it's over. They're going to move on. And since you both cover money and politics, I wanted to ask you about a Politico piece that ran recently called Koch Network Pledges to Defend Republicans Who Vote Against GOP Health Bill. It's by Kevin Robillard, and here's the lead. The Koch Brothers network of well-funded outside groups say it will spend millions to protect Republicans who oppose the party's health care bill from political fallout. Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Partners are teaming up to create a seven-figure reserve fund to support lawmakers who buck Trump and Ryan on the healthcare vote as the threat of primaries loom over some opponents of the group. The Kochs say they will spend money on paid media, grassroots canvassing, direct mail. It goes on and on. Justin, can you talk about this and why this segment of the story isn't getting more attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the dynamic here is a sort of interesting split within the Trump administration and the Republican Party, with the sort of Freedom Caucus and Koch people, you know, trying to be in the driver's seat, and Trump is not necessarily going along with you know, with quite everything they want. So, you know, I think it's sort of just an extension of why this bill seems to not not be headed for passage today, that the Koch network came out and said this publicly. I mean, another thing I think hasn't gotten enough attention are just the promises that Trump has made in recent months about healthcare that are completely different than things you hear from Paul Ryan or from some of these Koch brothers groups. I mean, Trump, gave this important interview to the Washington Post back in January, where he said he had a plan that was about to be released, a healthcare plan that was going to provide healthcare for everyone at lower cost, and he said it was going to be released imminently. That now appears to have been just a complete, total lie. He never seems to have had a plan, or if he does, it hasn't been released yet. It's certainly not one that does that. And that's not something that people like Paul Ryan or some of these Koch-affiliated groups even want. So I think that the cleavages around this are what you're seeing with this Koch move, and also with the apparent failure to get the votes today, although it's still not totally clear.
Right. Paul, what are your thoughts on this, and what do you think of media coverage of the Koch brothers' connections to these politicians who are members of this Freedom Caucus? A lot of these guys, mm-hmm. I think most of them are men, they got this job after the Tea Party exploded, which was directly connected to the Koch brothers.
Yeah, well, yeah, the Freedom Caucus is all men. That is something you can note. I think that this is a continuation of the sort of Tea Party wars that we saw emerge in 2009 and 2010 within the Republican Party, where you had this split, between the Koch brothers, Heritage Action, which is another conservative group, Freedom Works, and sort of pushing these hyper-libertarian candidates. And in more recent years, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which supports this bill, and Paul Ryan has come out and sort of opposed them in a lot of primaries and pushed back against Tea Party challengers, probably more recently in Mississippi's Senate election in 2014. And so you have this dynamic of sort of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is just kind of a pro-business lobby that sides with the Republican Party, and that, the Koch brothers network that is much more hyper-libertarian, free market. They're gonna oppose this bill because it does include some kind of tax credit and doesn't completely eliminate the Medicaid expansion. They would like to see all of that gone away with. So, I think you have that continuation of that split in the party that has been ongoing, and then you also throw Trump in the mix, who is, in the past endorsed single payer and said he's going to have some plan that'll cover everybody. But, who can believe anything he ever says?
That is Paul Blumenthal. He's a reporter with the Huffington Post covering campaign finance and money and politics. Justin Elliott is an investigative reporter at ProPublica covering politics and government accountability. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about money and politics and lobbyists, and we're going to talk about Justin's piece about the hundreds of people Trump has quietly installed across the government. What are your thoughts on issue coverage of these very important issues? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Justin, you and two colleagues obtained a list of more than 400 Trump administration hires. These include dozens of lobbyists, some from far-right media, and these are positions that have quietly been filled. How did you and your colleagues get your hands on this list?
My colleague Al Shaw was filing some Freedom of Information Act requests, and one of them was to a government agency called the Office of Personnel Management, which is basically the HR office for the federal government. Somewhat surprisingly, given the delays that are often associated with these public records requests, they actually got back to us with this list of people that the administration had hired in the first couple weeks of Trump's term.
And what stood out for you? You write that healthcare lobbyists got hired, a lobbyist for defense contractors, a New Hampshire Trump supporter who's only recently graduated from high school. What really stood out for you in this list?
Yeah, a couple things stood out. I mean, first of all, you know, the backdrop to this is that President Trump has not been nominating people for many positions that require Senate confirmation. So, you know, even below the cabinet secretary level, there's deputy secretaries and ambassador jobs. I believe there's about 400 jobs throughout the government that require confirmation by the Senate. That process allows for scrutiny of the backgrounds of the people who are being put up for these jobs, and also it allows for a sort of public discussion of the administration's policy positions and priorities. I mean, we saw, for example, with the Labor Secretary nominee, Andrew Puzder, he went through the Senate process, and we learned that, you know, there were serious domestic violence allegations against him. There were serious allegations about mistreatment of workers at his companies, and he ended up having to drop out. So that's really what the process is designed for. Trump has said that he's not sure he even thinks some of these jobs need to be filled, and so it's been widely noted that he hasn't been filling many of these jobs. So one of the interesting things here is, at the same time that he has not been filling these Senate confirmed jobs, he has been hiring people on these what they're calling beachhead teams, which are these 4 to 8 month positions at different federal agencies for in some agencies these are really the only representatives of the Trump administration at this point. And we still have a lot of questions about what these people are doing, but what this list showed, you know, as you mentioned, there were dozens and dozens of lobbyists. I mean, people who, in some cases, a few months ago were lobbying the agencies that they're now working at for, you know, private interest companies. And there are also some people from the sort of far right online world, people who, writers for Breitbart, and that sort of thing. And, you know, we've been asking the Trump administration for these names for weeks and weeks, and they hadn't released them, so we were finally able to get it through this public records request. So, you know, I think one of the main takeaways is that Trump ran on draining the swamp. If you look at all of these lobbyists he's hired, you know, he has completely betrayed all of his campaign rhetoric about draining the swamp. He actually explicitly said in the campaign that he wouldn't have a problem banning lobbyists from the administration. They've made a complete 180 on that. He actually weakened some of the Obama era ethics rules around that. So, you know, we still have a lot of questions about what these people are actually doing, but that's sort of one of the main takeaways.
And in your piece, you find that a number of former healthcare and pharmaceutical lobbyists have been hired by Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. And then, Paul, you have stories about how a lot of lobbyists are holding their annual events in Trump properties. For example, in his hotels at Mar-a-Lago, you report that the American Land Title Association, the main lobbying arm of the title insurance industry, will host 1,000 members of its annual gathering in October at the Trump National Doral Golf Course and Resort in Southern Florida.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of these trade associations, lobbying groups, have these annual conventions for their members, or they'll have a lobbying day here in Washington, D.C., and their members will come to a hotel or a golf course, and, you know, I guess some of these Trump properties are particularly popular, but in this day and age where the President of the United States has decided not to divest himself from his business interests, these lobbying groups are essentially paying the President to use their property, and then they're going to go meet with people in his agencies, meet with members of Congress, meet with people in the White House, and ask for policy changes that would benefit them financially while also personally benefiting the President of the United States and his family as well. So, I mean, it's a clear conflict of interest. Now, a lot of these events that have been reserved for this year were booked years in advance, some of them booked in 2014. So, I mean, to some degree, that's an excuse for a lot of these associations. You know, I looked at the American Land Title Association. There was also the Metal Services Industry Association, which is a, you know, steel and aluminum supplier trade group that lobbies in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline, the Dakota Access pipeline, and other kinds of policies that the Trump administration has sided with them on, and they're also holding an event at the Trump National Doral Golf Course. It really creates this situation where you're creating this obvious appearance of a conflict where you're paying the president of the United States. I mean, when I cover campaign finance, and there's more of a step aside from a direct payment when you're giving a campaign contribution, but there's still that appearance of a conflict or even an appearance of corruption that could emerge from that. Here you literally have them putting money in his pocket. And I think that it couldn't really be clearer than that, the problems that have emerged with Donald Trump deciding to keep his business, even if he put his two adult children in charge of managing the day-to-day.
And just this morning, the State Department approved a permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. We have a couple calls. Before we get to the calls quickly, Justin, what are you hearing from people who work in these federal agencies, people who dedicate their lives to government service?
Yeah, I mean, since we published a story about the Trump beachhead people that have been hired, I've heard from civil servants in a number of agencies, and there's some variety of experience, but I would say the main theme themes are chaos and confusion. I heard from somebody at one agency who said that they were involved in briefing the new administration beachhead people, and they would brief one person and then they would leave a few days later and new people would come in, they'd brief them, and this happened four or five or six times. Some of these agencies, I mean, like the Department of Labor is a good example. There is no Secretary of Labor. There's, as far as I know, there's not a single Senate-confirmed person working at the Department of Labor. Somewhat mysteriously, there's actually already changes being made in Department of Labor regulations. To give one quick example, there was this Obama-era rule called the fiduciary rule, which has to do with financial advisors on retirement accounts acting in the best interest of their clients. This was the subject of a fight that went on for years in the Obama administration. The rule is about to go into effect, and the Labor Department under Trump, it seems to be trying to delay it, possibly ultimately kill it. The only people at the Labor Department are the members of this beachhead team, which include, by the way, a former lobbyist for a financial services company that opposed this fiduciary rule, to give one example. It's very unclear whether these beachhead people are sort of calling the shots on these policy issues, or whether these are directives coming down from the White House, and that's in keeping with what I've heard from career civil servants, that they don't really know what's going on, and there's sort of confusion and paralysis in at least some agencies.
Well, let's take a call before we end. Let's hear from John in Palo Alto. Hi, John.
Well, thanks for taking my call. With all due respect, I think journalists in Washington are missing something that's hidden inside that the undue influence. John,
sorry, can you repeat that? We have a bad line with you.
Yes.
Sorry, bad line. I wish I knew what he... Do we know what John wanted to say?
Not sure.
I was just asking... All right, we'll move on. You guys are going to be really busy over the next 4 years. How are you prioritizing what to focus on? Justin?
Sure. My colleagues and I at ProPublica, many of us have sort of dropped what we were doing before the election to focus on the new administration. We've been put on different beats, and we're just sort of trying to cover issues that really, have an effect in people's lives. It's been a sort of chaotic first few months. I mean, the amount of interest from readers, as well as information coming to us from people in government, all of that has totally changed since the election. And so there's definitely been some sort of scrambling to try to confirm tips that we get. Sometimes they turn out to be true, sometimes they don't. But you know, we're still sort of figuring it out, but we're totally committed to covering the new administration, holding Trump accountable.
And Paul, what about the role of lobbyists? I mean, this is nothing new, but under the Trump administration, everything has been taken to a new level. How do you see the role of lobbyists differ in this Trump administration from, say, the Obama or the Bush administrations?
I think that probably the role here is that there's somewhat more uncertainty. I mean, this is a somewhat different administration than a lot of the previous ones. And, you know, they may actually wind up implementing a lot of the similar policies that you'd see from a very conservative Republican administration. But at the same time, it's just the uncertainty and instability of the man at the top, Donald Trump, that may make people a little bit more unsure about how to go about lobbying, or, you know, with this, the filling out of the administration posts, as Justin was talking about, you know, oftentimes those get filled up with lobbyists. And I think that there might be a lot of people who don't know if they want to actually go near this administration because it seems incredibly chaotic. And I mean, we're not even 100 days in, and it's not like they've gotten a lot done, but it has seemed like an incredibly chaotic and unsteady pace to be going at. As a reporter, like, you know, there's so much news every single day, every single week. Right. Sometimes it can be hard to keep up with what's going on, even if it's not even the implementation of any actual policy. They seem to be failing on their health care bill. They failed on their Muslim ban. And I don't know what the next thing is. I guess tax reform.
And just quickly, Justin, what would you add to that? The role that lobbyists are going to play in the Trump administration and how it will differ from past administrations.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think we should forget that there were plenty of lobbyists in the Obama administration as well. Although Obama did have somewhat tighter ethics rules around lobbyists joining the administration. I mean, based on what we've seen so far under Trump, it seems like, if anything, he's bringing in more lobbyists than Obama. I mean, one thing I'm also very interested in is this comment that Steve Bannon made a few weeks ago about the quote-unquote deconstruction of the administrative state. You know, the fact that Trump is not filling all of these Senate-confirmed jobs or not even nominating people for them, I'm interested in the question of whether this is just sort of incompetence or delay, or whether it's part of some sort of more deliberate strategy, you know, to deconstruct the administrative state. And if that's, you know, I'm curious if a lot of these jobs stay unfilled, whether does that open the door for more influence from lobbyists? I don't know. It all seems, at least on that front, it seems unprecedented.
Justin Elliott is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. Paul Blumenthal is a reporter with The Huffington Post. Thank you both for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org.